One former female employee alleged that you said, quote, I would do you in a second.
This is Michael Bloomberg, founder of one of the most successful firms in the world, billionaire extraordinaire and no-nonsense politician. But Bloomberg didn't start like that. In fact, on a fateful day in the 1980s, Michael Bloomberg is thrown out of Wall Street with the trash, booted from the company he has worked for, a company he has dedicated his entire life to, one of the largest and most infamous Wall Street investment banks at the time. For 15 long years, Michael has been working to the bone, slaving away for this company, and at the snap of a finger, he's gone. Needless to say, he's hurt, and he is pissed.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Nobody likes to be told, hey, you're history, you're out of here. I don't care how much money they give you. It's a rejection. It's embarrassing. It hurts your ego, and you start thinking they're wrong and that sort of thing. But it didn't matter whether they were right or wrong. The fact of the matter is, one day I was there, the next day I was out.
He has to make a decision. He can call it quits and retire, or he could make the riskiest gamble of his life so far. Today, Bloomberg presides over a financial behemoth.
Started in one room office. Today, Bloomberg has 19,000 employees in 120 countries around the world.
His ownership over his firm makes him the 12th richest man in the world, with a staggering fortune of $76 billion. His unbridled ambition allowed him to conquer his loftiest goals with clinical precision.
The harder you work, the luckier you get.
His life has been a wild roller coaster, marked by scandal as much as success.
A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
First, Mike, have you ever sexted on Snapchat?
I'm afraid I can't answer that question.
Whether you love him or you hate him, you can't deny that he's changed the face of Wall Street forever.
Michael Bloomberg.
Bloomberg's.
Bloomberg. Bloomberg.
Mike Bloomberg.
Michael Bloomberg.
Michael Bloomberg!
Today, I'm glad to announce that I am running for president to defeat Donald Trump and to unite and rebuild America.
Michael was born on Valentine's Day, 1942, in Boston, Massachusetts.
My father was a bookkeeper for a dairy in Somerville, Massachusetts, which was owned by a company in New York that my mother worked for, and somebody fixed the two of them up. They got married, and 10 years later had me.
At the time, the world is embroiled in the devastating Second World War.
The attack on Pearl Harbor ended the great American debate. Isolationism was no longer possible. Its most vehement advocates could see that now. And America was finally united.
After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, America has just joined the war, while the majority of Europe lives under cold-blooded tyrants. In the war economy, the factories that once built washing machines now make bullets. Michael's immigrant Jewish family enjoys safe haven in America.
But my father was a bookkeeper for a little dairy company, and he went to work 7 days a week right up until he checked himself into the hospital to die. And I think you can't help but be formed by your parents, their work ethic.
They don't have much, but the family has each other.
My parents taught me of hard work and honesty and sacrifice as well. In this neighborhood, I shoveled the snow in the winter. If the plow plowed them back in, I had to go back and dig them out again.
My mother made sure my sister and I waited at home for my father to come for dinner. We always ate together as a family, and we went around the table and talked about what we did that day. And so I remember discussing charity. We'd collect for some cause in the neighborhood. I was a Boy Scout and sold Christmas wreaths to raise money for a few things. And My sister did the same kinds of things. But if you look back and say who was the most influential in setting your life on the right course, it was clearly, in my case, my parents.
Mike begins to build an appetite, dreaming of something bigger and something better for his own life. While in high school, he does odd jobs to help out.
Worked my way through because we didn't have any money. It was the only way we were going to be able to pay the bills.
One of them is working for a local electronics company. He enjoys it, and under the advice of a colleague there, he applies for the electrical engineering degree at Johns Hopkins University. Michael speaks to enjoying the leadership position and being the big man on campus. After developing a taste for frat parties and drunken degeneracy, Michael receives sobering news. On the 28th of April 1963, Michael is told that his father has passed away from heart failure. All at once, he is now the man of the family. Michael graduates in 1964 and immediately enrolls into Harvard Business School, land of those talented enough to earn a place, or privileged enough to buy one. There, Michael rubs shoulders with the heirs of big business magnates, and for the first time, he starts to see wealth on a scale like never before. Deep down, he harbors a jealousy for those whose family names land on the newspapers, for those that have it so easy. He finally graduates in 1966 with an MBA and in the same year gets his first big break, working for one of the largest Wall Street banks at the time. The bank's name? Solomon Brothers. Recognized as a bulge bracket bank, meaning one of the leading investment banks at the time, it will eventually have its own dark demise, but that's a story for another time. To have a Harvard MBA is no small feat, especially in the 1960s. Whilst other Harvard graduates land cushy jobs as analysts and investment bankers, Michael is surprised as his career kicks off in a place nicknamed The Cage, an unair-conditioned, sweaty hell of a bank vault. You see, in those days, prior to the dawning of the information age, even the most basic transaction has to be carried out by hand. For each and every loan the bank took out or lent, some poor soul had to sit there and count mountains of bearer bonds and stock certificates as collateral for loans. That poor soul would turn out to be Michael. He spends his summer in 12-hour shifts, working in his underwear on account of the heat, doing the most boring, repetitive, brain-numbing work possible. Gritting his teeth, he sticks it out and after a year of moving his way up the ladder, he's finally promoted to the trading floor. This, my friends, is the beating heart of Wall Street. Billions of dollars being moved in minutes, sweaty brokers screaming over each other, arguments flaring up between big personalities. Nowadays, it's mostly computerized. You can place an instantaneous trade from your phone. Back then, though, if you wanted to buy a stock, the only way was to call a broker. It is chaos. A pure chimp-eat-chimp dominance hierarchy. You leave your computer unattended, someone steals your trades. A colleague finds out your client's phone number, suddenly Jim wants a new broker. Nothing is sacred, nothing is off the table in the jungles of Wall Street. They cram hyper-competitive people together, shoulder to shoulder. Anyone, not an alpha male, is forced out, and those that remain, the victors, the ones that not only survive in the madness but thrive in it, receive spoils one can only dream of. Michael becomes the new stockbroker of Solomon and breathes a sigh of relief. His Harvard MBA gives him no special treatment here. In fact, it's a point of ridicule. Every mistake he makes, every misstep he takes, his superiors will come down hard on the Harvard prima donna. Out of the back office, he finally has his hands on a real opportunity, but the relief soon vanishes. The pressure begins to weigh on his shoulders. From here on out, the future of his career at this company hinges solely on his performance. Michael joins the other stock traders and becomes a member of the block trade team in its infancy. But what is a block trade? Well, imagine you are a high net worth individual and have your eye on an up and coming stock and you want to invest big time. Now, normally to do this, you would buy shares on the open market, and to buy one or two shares, that's not a problem, obviously. But what if you wanted to buy 1 million shares? Well, there may not even be 1 million shares floating around for sale. Even if there were, the minute you place a huge order like that, it's going to overwhelm the market and the price will skyrocket. So, what do? You move away from the open market through the shadowy back alleys of Wall Street and get in touch with dark pools. These days, block trading is everywhere, but back then it was a novelty. Michael's block trade team is tasked immediately with drumming up business. Under the tutelage of a fast-talking salesman called Jay Perry, Michael absorbs the art of selling like a sponge, and eventually he discovers he has a knack for it. In his own words,
"Perry and I were a dynamic team. We could sell anything to anybody. If you wanted to dispose of a block of stock, we probably could have convinced your spouse to buy it. It has a strong specialist behind it. I'd tell one buyer who might not have the slightest idea why the specialist mattered."
Or,
"You buy this and we'll help you sell that," as if we wouldn't do either separately.
Jay Perry would later get into a fistfight at the company and removed from the office. For now though, Michael hones his ability to sell under Perry's wing. A good salesman on Wall Street is worth his weight in gold. As his sales grow bigger and bigger, he starts to draw attention within Solomon. So much so that one day, Michael finds himself on the phone, on the brink of closing one of his largest trades yet. All he has to do is just convince one person, hands fidgeting, heart in his throat, and his blood pumping in his ears. Then, he notices for the first time the partners looming behind him. These are the head honchos, the made man in the Solomon Mafia. Impressing these men is the difference between ascending the ranks or a bullet in the back of your career. The partners don't utter a word, no encouragement, no threats. They quietly assemble and watch. Bloomberg can feel their eyes boring a hole in his back as they watch on silently, and Mike does everything in his power to close the deal. After haggling, carousing, and a little bit of begging, in the end, he closes the deal. The partners walk away without a word. Bloomberg smiles. He's the golden boy. They know it, and so does he. With Michael's rising success, so come the spoils. His salary grows exponentially, and his colleagues teach him how to spend it. His eyes widen at the frivolities money can buy: limousine rides, fancy restaurants, golf excursions, you name it. From the beginning, Michael never intends to stay at Solomon. Now though, he's making more money than he ever dreamed of, and enjoying a lifestyle almost otherworldly. So why leave? Days go by, months pass, and years creep along for the golden boy. His goal changes, and he becomes laser focused on becoming partner. At the age of 31, 9 years since he started working at Solomon, he finally achieves it and is anointed as a partner. He now heads the securities and equities division. Is he growing to abandon megalomania for an above average lifestyle as a bulge bracket bank partner?
"Probably your first setback, which you write about in your book, as I read, was at Salmon, after Salmon was bought."
Well, I got fired after 15 years.
I'll let him say that, yes.
People always are afraid to say that.
I was going to get there.
I can just tell you it should happen to every one of you. It was the best thing that ever happened to me, and of all the people on the executive committee that fired me, sadly, one is no longer alive. He died in an airplane crash, but the other six are all paying customers, so... in the end, thank you very much.
Michael's exit from the company comes like a dagger in the night. It is a day like any other. He goes to work on the subway, arrives at 7 a.m. like always, and is about to start work when he is called into a top secret hush-hush meeting. Everyone who is anyone is there. And that is that. The company is merging with Philbro Corporation, a commodities trading firm, and you are either staying or leaving.
And then ultimately, when Salomon was sold, Mike was fired.
Up to this point, he has been with this company for 15 years, his entire professional career. He has worked his way up the ranks, brought in untold fortunes for the company, and as easy as that, he is out. The zeitgeist at this time is you enter a firm and you live and die for that company. Fate has other plans for Bloomberg though, and he is still trying to figure out what they are. You see, Bloomberg faces a crossroads. He is paid out $10 million as his compensation package. He can retire with that, but in his heart he knows that it's not an option. He's one of those fidgety types and can never keep his hands still. So, what then? Well, he could try to join another company, but having the door slammed at him after 15 years, he's not especially eager to go back to working for somebody else. Then, he has an idea. Prior to his dismissal from the firm, Bloomberg became entangled in a war for domination with the other partners. A war he lost. As a result, he was ousted from securities and equities and banished to information systems at Salomon Brothers. Although intended as a punishment, it turns out to be an immensely valuable experience. For the first time, he starts to interact with and learn about technology and how these systems could become a powerful tool. For a business to be successful, the product must solve some real problem. Bloomberg immediately recognizes a prominent problem facing Wall Street: the lack of timely, accurate data. Bloomberg practically smells the potential as he recognizes that Wall Street is in the caveman era of data. Bloomberg takes his biggest gamble yet, and in an effort to solve this problem, he founds a company, naming it after himself.
The most valuable commodity I know of is information. Wouldn't you agree?
The tech industry is now in charge of the world's most valuable commodity. The resource in question? Personal data.
The value of timely, accurate data is incalculable. Those that trade in it find a highly lucrative business. Bloomberg is no exception. Today, it is an empire worth roughly $100 billion. An absolute behemoth. It has its own TV station, radio network, podcast, newspaper, but the crown jewel is the Bloomberg Terminal.
More than 325,000 of the most influential people around the world use the Bloomberg Terminal in business, finance, government, policy, and philanthropy. Every day, Bloomberg customers conduct millions of searches on the terminal, looking for information or news about executives, companies, and financial vehicles.
A precise, finely tuned instrument that grants you access to practically all financial information in existence. To rent just one will cost you $20,000 a year.
It's an incredible story and it's been an incredible business. So Google, we give our information for free, but Bloomberg does not. Bloomberg is expensive. It's something like...
Bloomberg is very inexpensive added. Thank you very much.
I'm getting there. No, but something
and
like...
What's more, my daughters have to eat.
For the professionals, it doesn't get any better than this. For Excel monkeys, a terminal is the ultimate flex.
On the left are all of the companies that sell parts and to General Motors. And on the right are all of the companies that buy General Motors output, generally cars. The different indices that General Motors stock is in. Here are the other companies that compete with them. Here are the big holders of their stock, analysts that follow it, who's on the board, who works in the company.
It didn't always enjoy such success though. In 1981, Bloomberg rents an office, furnishes it, and confident of his business's success, he hires almost 24 workers under his payroll, all of it to be paid for by his $10 million, and the company gets to work.
The early vision was providing information to people, and that's obviously something very close to our hearts at Google. And as you said, as we were walking around with our founders,
These are the days before the internet.
It was before the internet, and it was before PCs. If you wanted to get online and share data digitally, you actually shared it in an analog sense, because the computers were 300 baud acoustically coupled computers. You plugged the phone set in, and maybe you would, you know, after half an hour, you could get a couple of pages of information out. So I hired an engineer, a guy from Dartmouth, where my girlfriend went, Ron Harris, and we designed our own PC. And we built the keyboard, and had a company in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, I think, built it. All the keyboard manufacturers used to be in one place. We made the PC boards. I helped solder occasionally. We bought chassis and monitors, and then when it came to installation, I would go down at night or on weekends, and we'd crawl under desks installing the cabling. I'm glad Local 3 didn't catch us in those days, or the fire department.
However, he starts to get nervous as time passes and his new business starts to eat away at his cash mountain. With a wife and newborn child, doubt seeps in. At a second glance, the stack of money he has left isn't as big as he thought. Bloomberg starts to feel the pressure. They are churning through prototype after prototype. Before he knows it, he spent $4 million. If he doesn't do something soon, Mike's going to be flipping burgers at Wendy's. In his desperation, Michael makes a bold move. At a meeting with Merrill Lynch in an attempt to bag their very first potential customer, Michael begins explaining the value a Bloomberg system could bring to their company. Even the first terminal would be a game changer for them, he points out. A large mahogany table stretches before him, and at the other end sits Ed Moriarty, the head of the capital market division for Merrill Lynch at the time. While Michael comes to the meeting alone, Moriarty brings an army of suits. Lawyers, accountants, programmers, you name it. At the end of Bloomberg's presentation, Ed consults his team and they suggest that they should develop their own system. Why rent it from Bloomberg when they could just make it themselves? Bloomberg's heart sinks and his stomach churns. The only thing he can think of is how badly they need this cash injection, and he feels helpless as he watches the sales slip away from him.
How long would it take to develop?
Ed asks his team.
Well, if you don't give us anything to do, we can start in 6 months,
they answer.
We'll do it.
Bloomberg sees his opportunity and pounces.
We'll have it ready in 6 months, and if you don't like it, you don't have to pay for it.
Fair enough.
Ed responded, and with that, he leaves. When the last of the suits shuffles out of the boardroom, Bloomberg's mind races. Now they finally secured a contract, some cash flow assured, but how the hell are they going to build a functional terminal in 6 months? They need to get started. 6 months come and go. They can only be described as regular, chaotic 14-hour shifts at the Bloomberg sweatshop. Everything is on the line. The prototype has come far, but even on the day they are supposed to deliver the terminals to Merrill Lynch, software bugs are still surfacing, rendering it unusable. Yes, you heard that right. The thing wouldn't turn on. With his head in his hands, Bloomberg notices the taxi pulling into Merrill. It is hopeless. Silence fills the room, and Bloomberg swallows nervously as the terminal is plugged into the power socket. And then, a miracle. The machine whirs to life. Loading printed on its black screen. A wave of relief washes over Bloomberg. The bug has been fixed in the taxi. The rest is history. The deal is a resounding success, and over the many years, the profits and the size of the company grow and grow and grow. The small enterprise has grown into a titan of epic proportions, elevating its owner to the status of billionaire extraordinaire. Yet under the surface of this mega success story, a scandal is brewing. Before we get to the scandal, let's talk about something else scandalous. Do you remember that I was the co-founder of a metaverse project some time ago? Well, since then the Web3 industry certainly has been shaken by some dark players, but there are still some players that are building. One of them is Over, a decentralized infrastructure for an AR metaverse with their Map2Earn beta program. The founders of Over the Reality may be dreamers, but they have realized an innovation that solves the geolocation problem in augmented reality. Previously, AR experiences were held back by the limits of GPS accuracy, typically no less than 6 meters outdoors and virtually absent indoors. Over, on the other hand, has achieved an accuracy of 20 centimeters outdoors and indoors. This makes the system ideal for mapping and creating geolocalized experiences embedded in the real world. And the best thing? The Over mapping system empowers each user with a smartphone to become a mapper. With more than 923,000 active participants, Over is setting the standard for a decentralized AR ecosystem in Web3. On their website, you can buy both their token OVR and land called OVR Land. With that, you can stake your claim in the Over ecosystem by buying, selling, or renting OVR lands. On their website, you will also find their white paper, which is worth a read, as well as their team, which is composed of seasoned industry veterans. For more, visit the link in the description below. As a present for his 48th birthday, Bloomberg receives a booklet, a collection of all the things he said over the years titled The Wit and Wisdom of Bloomberg. Penned by Elizabeth DeMars, Bloomberg's chief marketing officer at the time, here are some of his sayings. If you have them by their bolts, their hearts and minds will follow. Don't get even. Get revenge. Our competitors want to take the food out of our mouth, and I won't let them. Characterization of competitors? Cokehead? Womanizing fag. You know why computers will never take the place of people? Because a computer would say that the sex of the person giving you a blowjob doesn't matter. Later in the 1990s, four female employees come forward and sue the company for sexual harassment. In their legal cases, they describe that Bloomberg has built the company with the culture of a frat house. He certainly has the experience. One of these employees alleges that Bloomberg said things such as,
"I'd fuck that in a second. I'd like to do that. That's a great piece of ass."
And,
"I'd do her."
Although never found guilty in court, the lawsuits and his little book of sayings will come back to haunt him later. The year is 2000, a new millennia, new hopes and a new page in the history books, more so for Michael than most. He's been running Bloomberg for almost 20 years now. It's changed so much from its humble beginnings into a behemoth. The company's most recent valuation puts it at $2 billion. It's expanded internationally, and the terminals have been installed in every self-respecting investment bank in America and beyond. Michael has achieved everything he set out to do. He has wealth beyond his dreams, prestige, and the recognition of his peers. He has private planes, helicopters, and owns homes in London, Bermuda, New York, Armonk. Ever the frat house billionaire, the Bloomberg Christmas parties are a spectacle to behold. On the millennium year, he throws a party of epic proportions. The theme? The seven deadly sins. The cost? $1.5 million. To quote the Sunday Times, the lavish-themed bash was held in a disused office block that took 10 days to refurbish, renovate, and prepare for the occasion. Among the attractions, spread over four floors, were massage and shiatsu rooms, manicure booths, a sushi bar, cabaret, casino, drag queens, a disco, and live bands. The renowned billionaire playboy, who once described his life as a wet dream, finds himself bored, terribly bored. He can't sit still. In fact, he's been quietly plotting his next conquest, and it is an ambitious one. You see, winning New York is not like winning any other city. It's the largest city in the US with a population now of almost 9 million people. In the political landscape, it's a key battlefield. Rudy Giuliani, the current mayor, is coming to the end of his second term and his time in office. prohibited by law to be mayor a third term, the next elections promise a new mayor with new ideas. Immediately, Bloomberg has some tough decisions to make. First off, which party to run for? Ideologically, he's been a lifelong Democrat, and New York itself is almost always a Democratic city with a Republican mayor elected once every 25 years or so. Leading up to the 2001 election, the mayoral seat seems like a cinch for whoever wins the Democratic seat. Ironically, because the Democrats are so well positioned for a victory in the city, running as a Democrat would be suicide for Bloomberg's campaign. Michael doesn't stand a chance to beat all the candidates that are lining up on the Democratic side, so he runs as a Republican.
Saluda Willy Colón. En este momento de crisis hay que unir la ciudad. El mejor candidato para lograr esto es Mike Bloomberg.
Michael Bloomberg is kicking off his campaign today.
He's getting into the game rather late.
Bloomberg faces an uphill battle.
And there's nothing there.
He's one big gaffe.
It'll never happen.
Bloomberg makes as much sense as to pick you instead of me to be on Broadway next Thursday.
Bloomberg, just no chance to win. No chance to win.
While the Democrats put up a crowd of elite politicians, Bloomberg faces only one Republican rival, Herman Badillo. He has run for mayor of New York in the last five election cycles, and he's lost every single time. This will be his sixth attempt at the seat. Then, disaster strikes. Two planes hijacked by Islamic terrorists crash into the World Trade Center towers. People all around the world are glued to their TV screens, and to this day they remember where they were when it happened. It's an act so vile, so heinous, so evil that it momentarily paralyzes the world, and it also rocks the New York political scene. The primary votes are delayed, and the typical topics of crime and housing were all firmly replaced by safety and security. Out of the rubble, an unlikely hero emerges. All eyes now lay on Rudy Giuliani. The entire international community waits and watches to see what the outgoing mayor does. To the surprise of some, the same mayor who was criticized for inciting racial hatred rises to the occasion. Because of his graceful handling of the situation, he is celebrated worldwide. And Rudy endorses Bloomberg for mayor, and a Republican victory, once scoffed at, now doesn't seem far-fetched at all. The votes for the candidate for each party or the primaries are pushed back till the 25th of September. And on that very day, Bloomberg trumps Badillo, winning 72% of the Republican votes. At the same time, Mark Green is crowned the official candidate for the Democrats and will face off against Bloomberg. They have 2 months until the final election, and the stage is set for war. The frontrunner of the race, Mark Green, seems destined to win.
I admire Michael Bloomberg. I think he's smart. He's a great philanthropist. The chance that he will or should be the next mayor of New York is equal to the chance I will or should be the next chairman of Microsoft.
Not only do the people know him intimately, he's worked public office before and he has a good reputation. Bloomberg, on the other hand, has never worked in public office. No one knows him beyond his extreme wealth. His reputation is somewhat tarnished from sexual scandals, his outrageous comments, and his membership in elite all-white clubs. Still, Bloomberg has one trick up his sleeve.
Say hello to my little friend!
While Mark Green has to count on donations to fund his campaign, Bloomberg doesn't have to waste his time pandering to donators. He only has one after all, himself, and he unleashes a flood of money. His campaign spends a whopping $73 million, breaking the record for the most money ever spent in a New York mayor election. Bloomberg even promises to only take a $1 salary if elected mayor. Mark Snidely. Bloomberg outspends Mark Green's budget by 5-1, and it shows. For that brief period of time, every building, every stadium, every TV station has Bloomberg for mayor on it. He even sends radios with his name on it to potential voters. Finally, the day of voting arrives. As the votes come in, it's a nail biter. But in the end,
mayor of the greatest
he wins. He wins re-election in 2005, even though he legally couldn't run for a third term in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Michael convinces New York that they need a businessman at the helm. He pushes overturning the term limit, and it passes. When he runs for re-election in 2009, he wins again.
In the political world, it's very unusual for somebody to be a success in business and say, I'm going to be a successful in philanthropy, but I also want to put myself in front of the public. But Mike did that. He ran for mayor in 2001 and won, took over shortly after 9/11 in New York and all the troubled times there in New York and around our country, and has now been now serving his third term. And as a result of what he's been doing in New York, he's actually made a real difference there. Today, crime is down 35% in New York since 2001. High school graduation rates are up 40% since 2005. Teenage smoking is down more than 50%. 725 acres of parkland have been added to New York City since he's been there. And since October of 2009, more private sector jobs have been created in New York than the other 10 largest cities in the United States combined. So he's made an incredible difference in the economy in New York and in terms of the health of New York. And the people who live there, their health is, I think, much better as a result of it, and their safety is much better.
Finally, in 2014, at the end of 12 long years in public office, he finally returns to his firm as acting CEO. It's the final moments before the debate. Bloomberg's going over his talking points while he gets last-minute touch-ups on his makeup. $600 million spent, 12 years in public office, and his whole life has brought him up to this point, the Democratic debate. Whoever wins here will become the Democratic candidate for President of the United States of America. This is it, Bloomberg thinks. Win here, and then he'll go toe-to-toe with his rival, Donald Trump. Before that, Bloomberg will have to vie against five other candidates for the most coveted position in the world. The green light turns on and he walks onto stage. Showtime. Michael Bloomberg has been out of politics and the limelight for a while now. Since 2013, he's been back at his firm, assuring its continuous rise and meanwhile enjoying his old age, taking time for the quiet moments, spending time with his family, drinking hot cocoa on a winter's day, giving speeches at universities, and flying a helicopter over New York. He's also gotten into philanthropy, big time.
And one of a growing number of extremely wealthy people who plan to give most of their money away, releasing a torrent of private philanthropy that is already having an impact on the country.
So much so that in 2019, he's the person who gave away the most money in the world. That should have been where the Bloomberg story ends. When he leaves office as the mayor of New York, many speculate he could use his newfound popularity to leapfrog to other public positions, maybe even president. Bloomberg never gives it serious thought, yet 2019 will be the year Bloomberg officially runs for president. Why? Two words: Donald Trump. Once the pair used to be good friends, both of them New York billionaires, and they shared a similar view of the world.
I did try and fuck her. She was married, so moved on her very heavily. In fact, I took her out furniture shopping. She wanted to get some furniture. I said, I'll show you where they have some nice furniture.
They circled the same social events, bumped into each other often, and got along amicably. When Bloomberg was still mayor, they even partnered to revitalize an abandoned golf course in the Bronx, where they both had good things to say about each other.
And I have to say, you have been a great mayor. Come here. You really have. I mean, this guy is fantastic.
If there's anybody that has changed this city, it is Donald Trump. He really has done an amazing thing, and this is another part of it. Donald, thank you for your confidence in the city.
That all changed in 2016 when Trump decided to run for president. In the eyes of Bloomberg, Trump's inflammatory campaign supported all the things he had spent his life fighting against. Making guns more accessible, abortion, clamping down on immigration with his infamous border wall, and intention to reverse progress on climate change. Every day he watches Trump's campaign and it inches Bloomberg back to action. Leading up to the election, he throws his weight behind Hillary Clinton, endorsing her run for president and slams Trump at the Democratic convention.
Most of us don't pretend that we're smart enough to make every decision by ourselves. And most of us who have our names on the door know that we are only as good as our word, but not Donald Trump. Through his career, Donald Trump has left behind a well-documented record of bankruptcies and thousands of lawsuits and angry stockholders and contractors who feel cheated and disillusioned customers who feel they've been ripped off. Trump says he wants to run the nation like he's running his business? God help us!
Trump strikes back.
Little Michael Bloomberg, who never had the guts to run for president, knows nothing about me.
I had a guy get up. Little guy gets up, knocked the hell. I said, I want to hit him back so hard. I'm going to hit this guy. I'm going to hit him so hard. You have no idea.
You were telling me backstage, you actually did have a phone call with Donald Trump.
I did, after he got elected and before he took office. Wanted me to know he wanted a call, so I called him. He was the pres-elect, and I don't have an ego, so okay. And he asked me what he should do. And I said, well, you don't know anything about a lot of parts of government. You've never been in government before. What you need to do is to get some people that have experience, try to find a bunch of people who are smarter than you. At which point he alleged that there weren't any. And then he gave me his private cell phone number, which I didn't bother to write down.
Fast forward 4 years, and Bloomberg has had to sit with a Trump presidency, all the while nursing a hatred for the man. Eventually, he takes matters into his own hands.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Late Show. Once again, we are live tonight following the Democratic debate from Iowa. My first guest is a billionaire media mogul who served 3 terms as mayor of New York City and is now running to become the Democratic nominee for president. Please welcome Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Late to enter, Bloomberg misses out on the first Democratic debate. However, as he watches his opponents, he realizes how stiff the competition is.
Look, I don't think anyone ought to be able to buy their way into a nomination or to be president of the United States.
But I guess if you're worth $60 billion and you could spend several $100 million on commercials, you have a slight advantage. That is nonsense.
Still, he continues campaigning. He spends $676 million on his campaign, all paid for by him, and breaks the record for most money ever spent on a presidential primary. His ads flood the country. He gets even endorsed by numerous notable individuals. Even Judge Judy. Leading up to the debates, he's in good shape.
The former New York City mayor qualified after a new national poll showed him in second place, trailing only Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Finally, the day of his first Democratic debate rolls around. A success here is everything. Walking onto stage, he's confident and ready. Little does he know, he's being led straight into a bloody ambush.
Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
In order to beat Donald Trump, we're going to need the largest voter turnout in the history of the United States. Mr. Bloomberg had policies in New York City of stop and frisk, which went after African American and Latino people in an outrageous way. That is not a way you're going to grow voter turnout.
The fact of the matter is, he has not managed his city very, very well when he was there. He didn't get a whole lot done. He had stop and frisk, throwing close to 5 million young black men up against a wall.
After a dismal debate, Bloomberg's strong position in preliminary polls falls off a crater. And after disappointing voting results, he drops out of the race and endorses Biden, who eventually beats Trump for the presidency. Following a lifetime of triumphs, Bloomberg has finally met one mountain he couldn't climb. To some, Michael Bloomberg is a monster, representing the dark underbelly of Wall Street, the man who bought his way into public office and abused his power in business and in government. To others, he's a soft-spoken man in his twilight years, a politician for the people, a beloved philanthropist, and a force for good. No matter which side you land on, his controversial legacy will endure, and so will his empire.